Chapter 2, Battles and Bewilderment. Politics has grown nasty, dangerously nasty. In recent times, political topics such as immigration, sovereignty, the EU, Jeremy Corbyn, Nigel Farage, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Vladimir Putin have become increasingly toxic. Personal relationships fractured as long-time acquaintances found themselves unexpectedly on opposite sides of spiralling, bad-tempered political disagreements. Former friends dismayed each other by championing views previously thought to be beyond the pale. "How can you believe such nonsense?" they gasped to each other in mutual bewilderment. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" For many people, social gatherings have become more delicate experiences. We have had to learn to tread gently on eggshells. A Private Eye cartoon captured this sour turn of events as it depicted guests arriving for a wedding ceremony. The guests were asked, "Which side of the family, Brexit or Remain?" Sitting with the wrong camp might provoke a bitter dispute that would overshadow what should be a happy occasion. With political discussions dominated by hostility and suspicion, it's no surprise that the conclusions of these discussions fail to take advantage of the collective insight latent in the community. Our best ideas are drowned out by the loudest voices or flashy distractions. The unwarranted certainty of true believers leaves little space for the collaborative exploration of more nuanced solutions. "The people have spoken," we hear. "You lost. Get over it." Section: Politics at the Speed of Light. Some might say that there's nothing new here. Politics has long had its unpleasant side. I was as far from the first generation in which people have been deeply troubled by the political opinions of their erstwhile favourite uncles or nieces. However, six factors deserve special attention as we hurtle towards 2020. 1. The numerous ways in which news items can nowadays spread rapidly around the world, aided by multiple connections on social media. 2. The proportion of these news items which are deliberately designed to mislead, being partially or totally false. 3. The way in which these news stories frequently tug on our emotions, triggering and amplifying feelings of us versus them, warring tribes. These stories set fire to our hearts and smother our rational minds in clouds of confusion. 4. The power of software to deliver individually tailored messages that are particularly effective in amending our political outlook. This software gains its strength by mining our online social media footprints, for example, our likes and our shares, and by selecting the optimal time and place to intrude in our news feeds. 5. The degree to which participants in debates care little about the truthfulness of the stories they share. Instead, in a so-called post-truth era, participants care much more about whether these stories will draw applause from fellow members of their own tribe, and whether they will cause anger or annoyance to their opponents. And 6. The speed of adoption of new ideas that formerly lay outside the bounds of respectable opinion. The unthinkable becomes thinkable much more quickly than before. Taken together, these factors mean politics is likely to become worse before it becomes better. They mean that we risk fiercer animosity, harsher irrationality, more trenchant silencing of critical thinking, more draconian restrictions on our freedoms, and sharper spirals into conflict and chaos. Behind these six factors lies the increasing pace of change of technology. The internet was widely expected to herald an age of unprecedented knowledge. You've no doubt heard the claim that a teenager with a smartphone has access to more knowledge than the president did a few decades ago. But it turns out that the internet can spread falsehoods just as reliably as it spreads truths. The ideas which leap across social media, propagating like viruses, gain their potency from their clickability rather than their accuracy. It's similar to the way that the earworm pieces of music that we find going round and round in our head are frequently far from being our absolute favourite pieces of music. These earworms thrive because of their catchiness rather than their profundity. The essayist Jonathan Swift lamented as long ago as 1710 that falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it. Swift sagely pointed out that even when people realize they have been deceived, it is often too late. The falsehood has already had an effect on them. Their opinions and dispositions have adjusted. They may have altered their loyalties without consciously realizing the factor responsible for that change. As Swift remarked, if a lie be believed only for an hour, it has done his work, and there is no further occasion for it. 300 years after Swift's essay, falsehoods can fly much faster than before. They circulate at the speed of light. They can also benefit from the fearsome ingenuity of one of the largest, cleverest industries on the planet, namely advertising, an industry that pays some of the world's brightest people huge salaries if they find new ways to capture viewers' attentions and change their opinions. In turn, this ingenuity depends on an increasingly rich understanding of the factors that motivate human action. The sad outcome of this richer understanding is that social media progressively amplifies confirmation bias, groupthink, bandwagon effects, and other cognitive biases. Rather than us becoming smarter, we have grown more befuddled. Section: Falsehoods on the Rise. Not only are falsehoods spreading more quickly nowadays, but they exist in greater number. The Washington Post reported in November 2017 that Donald Trump had made 1,628 false or misleading claims over the course of the preceding 298 days, an average of 5.5 such claims every day. The New York Times performed a comprehensive comparison between the false or misleading claims of Donald Trump and Barack Obama while president. Quote, "We applied the same conservative standard to Obama and Trump, counting only demonstrably and substantially false statements. The result? Trump is unlike any other modern president. He seems virtually indifferent to reality, often saying whatever helps him make the case he's trying to make. In his first 10 months in office, he has told 103 separate untruths, many of them repeatedly. Obama told 18 over his entire 8-year tenure. That's an average of about 2 a year for Obama and about 124 a year for Trump." End quote. The New York Times further explored the difference between Trump and previous presidents Obama and George W. Bush. Quote, "If we had used a less strict standard, Trump would look even worse by comparison. He makes misleading statements and mild exaggerations about economic statistics, his political opponents, and many other subjects, far more often than Obama. We left out any statement that could be plausibly defended, even if many people would disagree with the president's interpretation. We also left out modest quantitative errors, such as Trump's frequent imprecision with numbers. We have used the word lies. If anything, though, the word is unfair to Obama and Bush. When they became aware that they had been saying something untrue, they stopped saying it. Trump is different. When he is caught lying, he will often try to discredit people telling the truth, be they judges, scientists, FBI or CIA officials, journalists, or members of Congress. Trump is trying to make truth irrelevant. It is extremely damaging to democracy, and it's not an accident. It's core to his political strategy." End quote. These tabulations of the unprecedented extent of falsehoods by Trump produce vitriolic responses by Trump's fan base. The mainstream press, they reply angrily, are the ones who are publishing fake news, as never before. Chillingly, the language they use echoes that of Joseph Goebbels, the Reich Minister of Propaganda of Nazi Germany from 1933 to 1945. Trump's term, fake news, recalls Goebbels' use of Lügenpresse, meaning lying press. Professor of Marketing Philip Kotler commented in an article in March 2017, quote, "Trump's aim to subvert the press is clear. He calls the liberal news media fake news. He says the New York Times and the free press are not his enemy, they are the enemy of the American people." Is this familiar? Isn't it reminiscent of Dr. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's chief of propaganda? Goebbels' job was to use propaganda to prepare Germans to need a demagogue like Hitler to set right their grievances. Goebbels believed that if you repeated falsehoods often enough, they became facts in the minds of the ignorant and aggrieved. Goebbels needed to create a hated other, non-Aryans and Jews, who threatened the jobs and well-being of German Aryans. Ultimately, Goebbels managed to get compliance from political, academic, commercial, and military Germans through inculcating fear of being unpatriotic. After all, Hitler's mission was to make Germany great again. Goebbels needed the German public to see the press as the common enemy, not just of Nazis, but of the German people. Opposing the Nazis was equivalent to opposing the German people. Shortly afterwards, Goebbels shut down all Jewish newspapers and other messengers of decay. Later, he took over the radio stations to spread the Nazi message and vision. Still later, he used the film industry to further Nazi ideas. End quote. In reality, supporters of Donald Trump are generally well aware of the president's larger-than-life character flaws, his grabbing womanizing, his self-obsession, his unbridled nepotism, the long string of bankruptcies experienced by his businesses, and his torrent of unreliable statements. But they don't seem to mind. They have different criteria for choosing to stand behind Trump. BBC reporter Katty Kay put it like this in an article entitled "Why Trump's Supporters Will Never Abandon Him." Quote, "To understand why somewhere between 35 to 38% of Americans consistently approve of the job Mr. Trump is doing, you need to reframe the way you look at his voters. It's not what they are for that matters, it's what they are against. So it's not that a third of US voters are fervently on the side of Donald Trump. What's more relevant is that they are adamantly on the opposing side of a culture war that's been brewing here since the 1980s. End quote. Kay continued, quote, "Look at it like that, and you can see why it doesn't really matter what Mr. Trump achieves or doesn't achieve. He defies the normal metrics for success because his voters don't so much support him for what he does as they adore him for what he's against. Mr. Trump is against the political establishment, the media, the Republican Party, political grandees like the Bushes and the Clintons, and change, which encompasses everything you had but fear you are losing, and he's against the world, which has taken jobs and sent immigrants to take over America. If you believe America is engaged in a life-or-death battle over its identity, in which the past looks golden and the future looks, well, brownish, then Mr. Trump sounds like he's on your side." End quote. We cannot counter the escalation of unpleasant politics simply by appealing for participants to be more considerate, or more rational, or more conciliatory. Instead, we need to address the underlying motivations which are driving people into warring tribes. These motivations arise deep within human nature. These motivations extend far beyond goals of mere material improvement. Critically, they include an earnest search for meaning and purpose, a search to see oneself as being one of the good guys on the right side of human history. American author Upton Sinclair wrote in 1935 that it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. That quote rightly emphasizes how economic motivation to earn a salary can interfere with someone's reasoning abilities. But it's the same with other kinds of motivation. An amended form of Sinclair's quote would read as follows. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when the ideas that underpin his sense of self-worth depend on his not understanding it. These human motivations are neither intrinsically positive nor intrinsically negative. Like technology, these motivations are two-edged swords. They can lead to greater human flourishing, but can also lead to greater human alienation. As technology becomes more powerful, and as technology changes more quickly than in previous times, the likelihood increases for these underlying human tendencies to cause dramatic changes in human social structures. Technology will magnify effects that previously had lesser impact. We urgently need to recognize and harness these motivations before they trample us into a new dark age. Section: Beyond Homo Economicus. We humans cannot live by bread alone. Even when we have plenty of healthy food, pleasant shelter, and an abundance of material possessions, we frequently feel a strong yearning in our hearts for something more. We would be foolish to ignore that yearning. Psychologist Abraham Maslow postulated a hierarchy of needs. Alongside our physiological needs, we also have deep-seated desires for friendship, belonging, intimacy, esteem, and meaning. We can argue about which needs might be more important, but any approach to society that regards all participants as homo economicus, people who single-mindedly pursue their own financial well-being, is storing up problems. Any political policy aimed at maximizing GDP, gross domestic product, the monetary value of all the goods and services produced, risks leaving voters deeply unsatisfied. Regardless of how much bread, cakes, designer clothing, electronic gadgets, package holidays, and entertainment gizmos voters possess, these voters remain vulnerable to promises of would-be leaders who seem to offer a route to something more, the chance to attain meaning in some kind of historic or cosmic sense. This helps to explain the ongoing success of fundamentalist religious preachers. It also speaks to the success of new social movements that display at least some of the same otherworldly trappings. One striking feature of the Brexit debate in the UK was the way in which many people said they would prefer to leave the EU even if that imposed financial drawbacks. They could accept a short-term drop in the well-being of the economy as a price worth paying for what they saw as more desirable outcomes. Far better, they said, to be in control of our own destiny, to regain national sovereignty from unelected officials in Brussels, even if that move would, for a while at least, reduce trade. And far better to reduce what was perceived as a bewildering flow of immigration, even if these immigrants were, on the whole, adding to the national GDP due to their skills and industriousness. For these voters, there were more important factors to weigh up than economic prosperity. For a different example of personal motivations that rejoice in an adverse turn of events, consider this kick-in-the-teeth joke recounted by analyst Ronald Bailey of Reason. Quote, an old Russian joke tells the story of a peasant with one cow who hates his neighbour because he has two. A sorcerer offers to grant the envious farmer a single wish. Kill one of my neighbour's cows, he demands. End quote. Bailey comments as follows. Quote, research by two British economists, Daniel Zizzo of Oxford University and Andrew Oswald of Warwick University, suggests there is a good bit of truth behind that joke. In a recent study, Zizzo and Oswald ask, are people willing to pay to reduce others' incomes? The short answer to this question is yes, they report. Our subjects gave up large amounts of their cash to hurt others in the laboratory. End quote. Another Russian joke has an even harsher punchline. Quote, a genie says to a peasant, I will grant you any wish, but remember that I will give your neighbour twice what I give you. The peasant thinks for a while and responds, poke out one of my eyes. End quote. A different version of this joke has the peasant asking to be deprived of one of his testicles. Lurking behind the malice in these jokes is an important truth of human society. Progress depends not just on the heroics of individual performers, but also on the cooperation of people within groups. In turn, cooperation depends not just on reciprocity, I'll scratch your back if you scratch my back, but on the willingness of group members to punish free-riding cheaters in their midst, the people who take, or appear to take, more than their fair share of group spoils. Without individuals being able to punish these free riders, even at potential cost to themselves, the group would become torn apart by the selfish individualism of these free riders. Having lost its effectiveness, everyone in the group would suffer. For groups to survive, the well-being of the group sometimes needs to trump the well-being of the individual. Individuals with too many cows who threaten group harmony sometimes need to be taken down a peg. We notice strangers jumping forward in a queue, and we shout out to them to decry their behaviour, even if we are not directly impacted by the cheater. We may chase a mugger in the street at considerable risk to our own personal safety, because our blood boils with indignation at the callous selfishness of the perpetrator, even if we have never seen him or his victim before. Similarly, if the apparent elites of society apparently take too large a share of national wealth to themselves, or seem to disregard the opinions and needs of large sections of the electorate, then once again our blood may boil. Frustrated and overheated, we give our vote to those would-be leaders of society who draw attention to these issues and who claim that they'll do something about it. They promise to shake up the system. And even if our cool reason might tell us there is personal danger in trusting such leaders, just as there is personal danger in chasing muggers, our deep instincts tell us that this is our human duty. These instincts are a critical part of our human makeup. They can be a force for good as well as a force for ill. Alas, politicians of all stripes have grown increasingly savvy in leveraging these instincts for their own electoral gains. They deliberately stir up resentment and grievance. Provoked and outraged, electors are becoming more frustrated and more overheated. Cool reason is losing out. Section: In Search of Status. As I said, we humans cannot live by bread alone. We also need the support of social groups with whom we can identify. John Donne put the sentiment in verse back in 1623. Quote, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main." End quote. When members of our social group suffer, that's something which concerns us as well. Writing while seriously ill and facing death himself, Donne memorably phrased that insight as follows. Quote, "Any man's death diminishes me. Therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." End quote. Of course, we don't all articulate sentiments like John Donne. Many of us feel alienated from members of the groups in which we find ourselves located. We dislike their personalities, their prejudices, their quirks, and their hypocrisies. We may particularly dislike the apparent freeloaders and deceivers among them. We may actually rejoice at their misfortune, as per the misanthropic jokes mentioned earlier. But that doesn't negate our social tendencies. Disliking one group, we seek another, more suited to us, perhaps smaller, and perhaps more geographically dispersed. Social media makes it much easier to find such groups nowadays. We are drawn to these new groups, not specifically because they'll help us economically, but because we feel at home with them. They validate us. They speak to our inner needs. They give us a sense of belonging, even as we feel estranged from the other people in our surrounding. They help us find meaning, even as we lack sympathy for the stated goals of our previous companions. They make us feel cool, or part of a vanguard. They're in touch with a purpose seemingly far more worthy than the commonplace concerns of the mainstream. Because we value these new groups, we want to secure our bonds to them. It's not sufficient that we happen for a while to be part of such a group. Loose connections are subject to unravelling. Instead, we have profound human desires for status in the groups that matter most to us. With increased status, our longer-term security has deeper roots. We are less likely to be driven out of these groups, and we are more likely to benefit from whatever fruits can be shared in these groups: physical rewards, social relations, intimacies, privileged knowledge, and control over the evolution of the group. Our actions, therefore, often have the purpose of heightening our status in the groups that matter most to us. If we have a choice of banners to hold high, or a choice of which messages to publicise on social media, we reach a decision based not on whether a particular message strikes us as being true. Instead, what matters to us is the usefulness of a message as a signal. Will that message mark us as a valuable member of the group where we care to have good status? If so, then our subconscious mind will get to work, and the rational parts of our brains will adapt to these messages. It's as one of my friends of a friend said on Facebook, explaining why she passed on a particular photograph seemingly validating a rumour concerning past homosexual preferences of VP-elect Mike Pence. Quote, "I have not verified this, but wouldn't be surprised. Sharing just because, even if fake, it would piss this fucker off." End quote. A cursory online check quickly indicated that the photo in question had nothing to do with Pence. The photo featured a gay porn actor, Brad Patton, who actually only bore a passing resemblance to Pence. Nevertheless, sharing the photo served the dual purpose of annoying members of political tribes opposed by my friend of a friend, and drumming up excitement and approval in the tribe she identified with, the tribe objecting to the election of Pence and Trump. This is only one of very many examples of striking below the belt in recent political discussions. In such encounters, veracity limps far behind the fast-flying falsehoods. By the time any retraction might appear, confusion has multiplied, and the various tribes despise each other even more than before. Perversely, people felt good that they had strengthened their status within their own favoured tribes. But political division and dysfunction had accelerated. Section: A battle worth fighting. To fix politics, we have to work with these aspects of human motivation, rather than trying to block them or stunt them. We cannot simply tell people to value truthfulness higher than status within their social networks. That would be like trying to eliminate the spread of sexually transmitted diseases by persuading everyone to sign up for chastity. It's not going to happen. Instead, we have to recognize the reality of human drives and design systems in which these drives can coexist with better politics. Rather than asking people to suppress their inner desire to battle against perceived foes, we have to attract them to a battle that will channel their energies in a truly positive direction. Rather than asking people to compromise on their drives for meaning, community and purpose, it would be far better to provide a vision in which these desires serve tangible social and political progress. Step forward to the Transpolitica vision. The Transpolitica vision identifies an immense battle to be fought. This is the battle to grasp the radically better future which technology is placing within our sight. Taking part in this battle will provide participants with a profound sense of value and with a community of great significance. But in this case, the battle is no longer against a separate group of people. It's not against a nationality, such as foreigners or immigrants, nor is it against people from a different class in society, such as elites or capitalists. Instead, the enemies in this battle are bad ideas and bad systems. The enemies also include the inherited aspects of human nature which make all of us prone to trip up in our reasoning. Serious cognitive flaws, such as confirmation bias, status quo bias, bandwagon effect, gambler's fallacy, base race fallacy, hot hand fallacy, survivorship bias, false memory, anchoring, and the Barnum effect, which is one reason people too readily give credence to horoscopes. Another enemy that the Transpolitica vision needs to battle against is fear. The growth of fear drives people to identify more tightly with the groups they see as providing their identity and security. As such, fear polarizes communities and poisons the climate of political debate. In the next chapter, we'll explore the deep sources of these fears and explore how to turn these underlying sources into a positive rather than a negative force.